welcome our listeners to this broadcast of Shooting from the Hip. I'm Jeff Pedro, in with Mark Avery, and we're from Sim Trainer, the Dayton area's first indoor range and firearms training center. We're located at 2031 Dryden Road, just across from DP&L. You can visit us on the web at www.sim-trainer.com, or you can give us a call at 937-293-3914. We'd be more than glad to talk to you about any of your shooting-related interests, whether it be selecting a firearm, taking a class, whatever it might be. I'd like to remind our listeners that we have a variety of classes coming up that you may be interested in. First and foremost is beginning Monday, June 13th at 5:30. We have our CCW, our concealed carry class, that's beginning. It will be offered from Monday through Thursday evening, the 13th through the 16th. That's 4 evenings, 4 hours each evening, and that will enable you to, completion of that course will enable you to apply for your CHL permit in your local sheriff's office. We also have our basic handgun class coming up a week from today. That's the 18th of June, and that will be from 4 to 8 in the evening, next Saturday evening, 4 to 8. And then we have our award-winning first shots class that will next session will be on June 23rd. That's a Thursday evening from 6 to 9. And again, first shots, for those of you that may not be too familiar with that, that's the class that we try to encourage people who have little to no experience in the shooting sports to take that class to get acclimated to the use of a firearm in a very safe and structured environment, and then they can decide where they want to go from there. But we have a variety of classes coming up, and we certainly encourage you to take advantage of that. I want to encourage any of our listeners out there, if you have any questions you want to get on the air today, give us a call at 457-1290. That's 457-1290, and we'll be more than glad to get you up on the air. I want to start today's show by just talking about something that kind of drew my attention in the news this past week in the Buckeye Firearms Association. I saw mention of the fact that a man in Huron County was arrested and found guilty of poaching a, what they called a trophy deer. During the course of that investigation, he was arrested. He was fined $200, and his hunting license was suspended for a year. And the part that I have to quite frankly tell you, I'm not much of a hunter, but I'm very supportive of hunting. The part that got my attention that I just would like to get some input from you callers is that the court ordered $27,000 restitution on the individual. And I just have to tell you, in my line of work, I see lots of crimes that are committed, and quite frankly, I've never seen a restitution award anywhere near that for any crime, regardless of how heinous it was. And I brought that, I submitted my concern, or at least my, I'm going to say, interest in an explanation to the Buckeye Firearms Association. I got a couple of very educated responses from some people who are obviously in the know, and their explanation was that, well, in 2007, the legislature apparently passed legislation that authorized the Ohio Department of Natural Resources to get involved in this process where courts can award these damages, restitution for these types of offenses. And I, even though that is the case, I just have to say that that seems to be me personally to be unreasonable. Now, even though the explanation that was given me by a couple of the individuals who obviously are in the know and who are big into hunting and have contacts with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, the first response was that that is in large part what ODNR relies on for its funding purposes. Well, again, I don't like to see fines and restitution going for maintenance of programs or upgrading of programs. And again, I like to think that when we fine people or we order restitution, it's going to be reasonable in nature. And what gets me is that if they feel – well, the other rationale was that the current penalty system isn't sufficient to curtail the illegal poaching of deer. Well, it kind of goes back to some of the dilemmas that we have with the firearms laws. If there's a problem with the laws, I think we need to change the laws and or – enforce the laws that are on the books and then impose the penalties. And maybe the penalty phase is the issue, but a $27,000 restitution for the taking of a deer just doesn't sit right with me.
Okay, I'm going to cut Jeff's mic off for a second and jump in here because as a hunter, although I've never actually been a successful hunter, I have been out wandering around in the field carrying various different implements for hunting. I understand this a little bit better because I've tracked some of this stuff, and this is not by any means the first time that this has happened. The restitution is based on the trophy nature of the buck that was taken in this case. Now, there is a fine for poaching, and that was the original $200. If you take any deer out of season, then that's the that's just the nature of that fine for the penalty for poaching and taking a deer out of season. But the rest of it is because trophy deer are a specially desired commodity by the hunting community and by those people who look to this as a means for identifying, you know, the older deer, the more savvy bucks. They're very hard to get. They are very adept at hiding. They like to send the does out in front of them to kind of take the as pawns to take the initial hits, and they stay in the background, and they're pretty savvy. So a very old buck, one that does have quite a significant rack, is a pretty tough catch. And when poachers go out of season and they take these deer, first they take them out of the breeding cycle, so that causes a decrease in the total value of the entire deer population. And those are the deer that you want to let get to a certain age before you take them. If they take them really a little bit early, or if they take them out of season, what they're doing is they're robbing the rest of the hunting community, the legal hunting community, from the possibility of getting one of these trophy animals. Now, I'm not personally a trophy hunter. My reason for going out is to get the meat and fill my freezer. I love venison. I think it's one of the most healthy meats God created for us to eat. And that's my objective. But I understand the rest of the whole game management process and why it's important that the trophy deer be allowed to grow the way they're supposed to, and that they be hunted by fair chase. A lot of times the poachers don't use a fair chase techniques. They go out in either spotlight or they set up bait areas, and they do things out of season when the bucks aren't quite as wary. And so for the legitimate hunter, when a trophy buck is taken out of season by a poacher, that just really changes the whole spectrum. Now, these particular penalties are based on the point score of the deer itself. In other words, measuring all the different tines and beams of the antler set, and they come up to a particular inch score. And when they get above a certain level, which I think is 200 points, then these extreme penalties kick in. The penalties are really more of a deterrent against taking these deer out of season. Yes, the $200 fine is supposed to be a deterrent. I don't think $200 these days is really enough to deter anyone who's serious about taking these animals. I really don't think, you know, given $200 today, what that will buy, it's, you know, not even two full tanks of gas in my truck. So I don't think that that's necessarily a large enough fine, and I would certainly support increasing the base fine for poaching to make it a little bit more of a deterrent. But it's the same thing comes down to the firearms laws. When criminals are going to do what criminals are going to do, a monetary fine isn't going to deter them because they don't expect to get caught. And a case like this, where someone gets caught and a severe fine is put on them, and that is broadly publicized, I think that does have more of a deterrent effect, much like the death penalty has a very significant deterrent effect on violent crime. And when you don't allow the death penalty to be one of the options on the table, then criminals think, okay, I can get away with this. Yeah, I might spend some time in jail if I get caught, but, you know, it's not going to cost me my life. So I don't have as much of a problem with these kind of penalties. I disagree that it's because that's what's used to fund the DNR. I don't think that's accurate, although, I mean, I'm sure that is used to fund DNR. But by the same token, the police use confiscated material in drug busts, in equipment, and in cash, and they are able to use that to purchase things specifically related to drug enforcement. In this case, if the DNR uses that money as specifically for anti-poaching efforts and for enforcing the hunting regulations, I don't have a problem with that.
Well, in comparison, you make a comparison. I just want to clarify. The drug money that we obtain through seizure funds is actual cash that is obtained as the result of the sale of the drugs. For example, just recently we confiscated just about $2,500 in cash from an individual who happened to have almost 100 capsules of heroin. He was going house to house selling heroin. So obviously that money was obtained in the proceeds. He had that money on him.
I understand
that. We seized it. That's different, in my opinion. That's different than after the fact, telling this individual he's fined $200, which I believe is way low. Maybe that needs to be in the thousands of dollars. But then after the fact, tell him that he has to come up with an additional $27,000. I agree wholeheartedly, and I'm encouraging the concept of deterrence through harsh penalties when related. I'm looking at the concept and putting this in the total picture of our criminal justice system and looking at reasonableness. And the problem I have with it is many of the actions that law enforcement officers take that we think are very reasonable are sometimes questioned by courts and certainly by citizens as being unreasonable. And yet, I'm not a hunter, and I don't mean to offend the hunters because I respect what you do, and I support it wholeheartedly. Mark will tell you when there's functions, we support those functions. We donate door prizes. My thinking is a deer is a deer is a deer. I know the concept of the one in a lifetime deer. Everybody tries to get that one deer, but again, $27,000 in restitution for a deer seems harsh to me. But I respect the opinions of those. And a matter of fact, the rationale that Mark gave is consistent with what Larry from the Buckeye Farms Association gave, and I totally respect that. I told Larry that. I know Mark knows I feel that way. I'd just like to know if there's some listeners out there who have a feeling either way. I'd like to hear what you have to say. Tell me I'm offline. Tell me I'm way out of line. That's okay. That's one of the purposes of the show, to discuss issues that are controversial. And I have to believe that when people read that, it at least got the attention of some of the other people that read it. And it wasn't only me that looked a little bit, thought it was a little bit slanted.
Well, and I hope that it's some of the poachers looked at that and said, yeah, maybe I'd better let that go. You know, I'm willing to take the $200 fine, but I don't think I want a $27,000 or $15,000 or whatever, you know. And we've had some that were just huge fines.
Well, Larry from the Buckeye Farms Association made reference to an individual who apparently, in another case, took a trophy buck that supposedly he turned around and sold the mount for almost $250,000.
Exactly.
I say in that case where there are proceeds, where he physically or monetarily gains in the proceeds, that's a totally different situation.
It is, but it isn't necessarily, because whether they actually mount it and sell it for that or they just have possession of it, there's the value. There is value in that. And they could have, I mean, you know, I understand that if they take the mount, the ODNR doesn't have can't really go out and then sell that, I don't think. So, you know, I understand that there's some different views on that. So give us a call at 457-1290. We're going to take our first break for the hour here in just a few seconds. So give us a call at 457-1290, and you can weigh in on that. Or maybe there's some other firearms issues that you either have comments about or maybe some questions about. Give us a call, and we'll get you up on the board. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
America, this is your blood brother Ted Nugent, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
I want to welcome our listeners back to this broadcast of Shooting from the Hip. I'm Jeff Pedro in with Mark Avery, and we've obviously stirred the pot, and the phones are fired up here. And Mark, why don't we go right out to the phones and see what we have?
Let's talk to Kathy in Dayton, who has a comment about deer poaching. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Hi. I was curious to actually have heard that somebody got caught for some poaching. One of the reasons why is because these guys that go out and do this get national recognition worldwide if they get a buck large enough.
Right.
And this is like the deer poaching Olympics. So I used to be an avid hunter and fisherman, and you never hear of anybody getting caught. And when I was a baby, my father was a game warden, and my mom had always talked about people getting caught, but I can honestly tell you, in all the years that I've done any hunting and fishing, I've never known anybody to get caught.
And this is clearly a very well-publicized case, but the Turn-In a Poacher program that the Ohio Department of Natural Resources has does find several of these people. They just usually don't get this much press because the deer that they've taken are not anywhere near this class of trophy. So when something like this happens, it's really a big deal.
These people make a lot of money. And my mom told me that my dad chased this guy forever. I'm trying to think of where that was. It was down south of Dayton, and Germantown, I think it was. Well, when my dad finally got this guy, his family was influential in the town. My family had to pick up and move. They got death threats and everything. And I'm 40 years old. This happened when I was like a newborn child.
Wow.
And I assure you that in the rural counties, there's probably more likelihood of some of those things going on when you get bands of families together who obviously can somehow put influential pressure directly or indirectly on individuals, and it's very unfortunate. And your case and your situation certainly sways me the other way. I totally agree that these people go out based on the facts that were presented to me in the rebuttal to my initial inquiry, that these people make large amounts of money, so therefore maybe the fines are in accordance with the actualities of what's going on, and you kind of substantiate that by some of the comments you made.
Called the Vandalia Police Department one time. I was going over the dam, and I found some guys on some four-wheelers spotting deer, and I called the Vandalia Police Department. They were like, oh, no big deal. I kind of thought, I wonder if that wasn't their friends out there.
I would venture to guess that wasn't the case. And I will tell you, when we get calls concerning wildlife, we contact the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, and they respond when available. But they, like everybody else, are short-staffed, and it's only based on availability. And by the time sometimes a ODNR officer comes clear across county, those people, like the ones you spotted, could have already picked up shop and left.
My mom had told me that the guy that my dad was trying to catch was an avid frog poacher, and he hunted bald eagles.
Oh, my.
And he was supplying all the local restaurants with frog legs, and he was hard to catch. When my dad caught him, he had waders on, and all the bait was in his waders.
Right. Yeah, they go to great lengths. There's no doubt about it. But thank you for calling the show and expressing your opinion today.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, too. Let's go out and talk to Will in Dayton, who's also got a comment. Will, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, thank you. I just kind of, like the last caller, believe that killing a trophy deer or any trophy animal, there is definitely a possibility of monetary gain from that to the person. Now, in this case, whether the gentleman or female was trying to actually kill this for that purpose, I don't know, but I have to say that I have spent tens of thousands of dollars trying to get a trophy buck legally, so $27,000 doesn't seem like it's enough.
I'm afraid, given my time and actual monetary outlay on chasing those guys and so far being completely dry, I kind of agree with that.
Yeah, definitely.
And Larry, in his rebuttal, did mention that was another issue, that there are preserves that are set up where people have to pay large amounts of money just to try to get a trophy buck, and they, regardless of whether or not they get them, they still pay the money. So obviously, you're in that boat.
And on top of that, when they do get one, then they have hundreds of thousands of dollars of extra fees based on the trophy quality of the deer. So you have to pay a huge amount in order to get the opportunity to hunt, and then if you're successful, it really costs you. So that's absolutely true. So, Jeff, thanks very much for stirring this pot. We need to take a break and go to the news center with Charles Van Sant here in just a few seconds. If you'd like to get on the program, either on this topic or any of many other topics related to firearms, give us a call at 457-1290. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Cam Edwards from NRANews.com, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip. Give us a call at 457-1290 if you'd like to be on the show today. We'll take your questions about anything having to do with firearms and firearms-related issues. Maybe you've seen a story in the news that has piqued your interest and you'd like to get more information about it. One thing that I kind of wanted to talk about is that this week I was in Arizona. I spent the week there, and I was traveling, I traveled with a firearm, as I usually do when I'm going, especially when I'm going someplace where I can carry. And Arizona has a constitutional carry system where you don't even need a license to carry. I do have a license in Ohio, and it is recognized in Arizona, so that gives me some additional capabilities when I'm out there. At any rate, traveling through a firearm with a firearm through the airlines is always an interesting experience. Sometimes it's very uneventful. Sometimes everything goes very straightforward, and sometimes it's not. And this was one of those times when it was kind of in between. In both airlines counters, when I checked in, the agent at the counter did not understand the correct procedures for transport of a firearm in luggage. Now, obviously, you can't take your firearm with you onto the airplane. It needs to be checked in baggage. But there are some very simple procedures for how you do that. You have the firearm unloaded and locked in a hard-sided case. The hard-sided case can't be pried open. I mean, so if you've got just a plastic case that's just locked in the middle and it's easy to pry up the edges, that won't pass muster. But as long as you have a case that will stay closed when it's locked, as long as you don't break the locks, then you can transport that in your baggage. If it's an outside case, a hard, like a gun case that's designed for transport and checking, then there's a tag that you have to fill in that has information about the flight that you're on and certification by you that the gun is unloaded and several other things. Then they put that inside the case, and the case is locked and it's sent through TSA, and they scan it and make sure that everything's okay. If you have a hard-sided case that goes inside another suitcase, all they have to do is open the outside case, see the locked case, and put that same certificate inside the case. In my case, it's a soft-sided suitcase, and I would not be able to transport a firearm in that by itself, but I have a hard-sided case that fits inside of it, and that's how I transport it. I had two different answers from the folks at the ticket counters, one here in Dayton that said, oh no, you have to have that ticket inside the locked case, and then that goes inside the soft-sided case, and then we can close that case and you can check it, and that's simply not correct. All you need to do is, if you've got a hard-sided case inside a soft case, all you have to do is put the tag, the certificate, inside the soft-sided case near the case with the firearm, and you're good to go. As it happens, he didn't believe me and checked with his supervisor. The supervisor confirmed what I was saying is correct, and we went on. And actually, he apologized, and I give him credit for being responsible enough to recognize that he's made a mistake and try to, you know, say, I'm sorry, that was not something that he'd understood. And frankly, there's a lot of misunderstanding. I've had the same thing on many different airlines where somebody either has been told something that was incorrect or they didn't understand it when they were told and they had a wrong impression as to what the requirements were. When I was coming back from Phoenix, they told me that if I did not have it in the case, then it had to be taped to the outside of the case. Now, if that's the case, that's a local procedure that was defined by either the local airline desk or by TSA in Phoenix. I don't know, and frankly, it doesn't matter. She was able to find some tape and tape it on there, and we went forward. But in both of those cases, it took me a little bit longer to get through the check-in process than it ordinarily would. I normally leave some extra time to take care of those kinds of issues, just in case. You never know what's going to happen. One time when I came out through Phoenix, I was traveling with my toy box, and I had 5 guns in it. I had a long gun and an AK-47, and I had 4 handguns in it. And so when I checked in, it got x-rayed through TSA, and they pulled it aside, and the guy asked to open the case. As I was opening the case, he said, well, you know, I don't really have to get in here, but I just kind of wanted to see what you had. And we spent about half an hour talking about the toys and guns in general, and it was a real good experience. And quite frankly, that is much more the case in most of the places that I go. The people are no longer quite have that big paranoia about the guns. At least the people that are in this, you deal with this on a daily basis and checking firearms through an Arizona airport. Yeah, that happens on a pretty regular basis. So it's not something that people should, you know, be particularly upset about or as they would find particularly unusual. But I just want to give folks a heads up that if you are going to check a firearm through baggage, and flight to almost anywhere, you need to pay attention and know what the rules are. I strongly recommend that you print off a copy from the TSA website of the way that you need to transport that firearm, what the conditions are. Have a copy of that with you that you printed in the last day or so before you fly, and have a same copy from your airline. Go to your airline's website. It's usually under special conditions or traveling with special things. You can usually do a search for firearm, and you'll be able to find on their website where their instructions are. Print those off as well and have them with you. So if you run into someone who doesn't know their own rules, then at least you have some printed documentation that you've gotten in the last day or so that lets them know, yeah, you've been paying attention, you know what the rules are, and you know what their website told you the rules are, and that's what you complied with. So just kind of a heads up to folks who travel. It isn't always smooth, but it's usually not that big of a deal either.
I also think that's a good idea, Mark. I was traveling recently, and I had something similar happen where when I went to the ticket counter, the lady asked if I was ready to check my bag, and I told her yes, but I have a firearm that I need to claim, and she goes, oh, I don't know anything about that. So she had to go get her supervisor, and then they had to go through the process, and obviously there was a little bit of confusion, but only took a little bit of time. But we need to understand that some of these people, it's not regular that people travel with firearms, and then obviously these people don't work regular shifts where that's occurring. So like so many other things, they're just naive to it. So you're going to have to put up with it. But like Mark says, it's best if you have their policies and procedures already printed out. And if there's any confusion at all, you can at least make reference so they can refer to their own policies and procedures, which like some of you that are out there listening, I'm sure if you went through the companies you work at, you're not familiar with all of your company's policies and procedures. You think you'd be very familiar with the ones that are important, like transporting guns on airlines. But, you know, like
checking
I said,
in.
Checking in, yeah. Basic things. But it is a good idea to take those measures into your own hands so that you can avoid those unnecessary delays, because those things are going to happen.
One of the things that I have found is that if you escalate an issue to the supervisor, just be very calm. You know, don't get upset. Don't take anything personally. Just say you'd like to speak to a supervisor, and this is an issue that you're pretty familiar with, and you have their rules lined out. You may or may not even need to say that. You say, yeah, I understand there's a problem here, and I'm not being contentious, but I would like to speak to your supervisor. And I have found that in most cases, the supervisors do know what the rules are. So if you have a problem, then escalating, bringing a supervisor in to get some additional assistance usually helps. One time when I was coming in through Atlanta, the gate agent didn't know the procedure, and I was explaining that I have a radio show and I talk about this stuff every week. So I do teach this stuff in classes, and I have a pretty good idea what I'm talking about. that may not have been the best approach, but she was actually pretty open to that. And I said, look, why don't we just go talk to TSA? And so she got me checked in, except for that last final part. We walked over to the TSA counter, and she asked them, and they confirmed exactly what I had told her. And she said, well, you know, that really surprises me, because we had just had an in-service training on this topic, and this is what they told us, and what they told us was wrong. So thank you very much, and I'll make sure my supervisors know about this and get that corrected. Now, quite frankly, the Atlanta airport, Atlanta Hartsfield International Airport, is one of the most anti-gun places. And the supervisors in that area, they have gone out of their way to make things difficult for gun owners. So it doesn't particularly surprise me that they might have the wrong information there. So you need to be aware of where you're going. There have been several situations where people are going through, say, New York or New Jersey, where they run into all kinds of problems. And there's a great article that I read just on the airplane coming down, where somebody said, if you have to get stuck overnight in a place that you weren't intending to stay there, so it's not a destination on your journey, and you're carrying a firearm in your baggage pursuant to 926A, which allows you to, that's a U.S. code, that allows you to transport through a safe harbor provision as long as you are able to legally possess on both ends of the trip, then you don't have to worry about what happens in the middle as long as you follow the certain parameters. And unfortunately, the way that New York is interpreting that, if you stay overnight, that's a destination, whether that was your intention or not. That's wrong, but one way around that is to make sure that you do not take possession of your baggage. Make sure that the airline retains possession and retains control of that, and you do not have to check it back in. If they force you to take it, don't take it, because that sets you up for a problem in those areas. If you're coming from, say, Vermont, and you fly through JFK or LaGuardia, and then you're coming back to someplace in the Midwest, obviously you're legally able to own in both ends of the trip. But if you stop in New York because of a weather delay or equipment failure or whatever, Don't take your bag. Just let them keep it, because if you have to check it back in again, you could well be arrested. And that has happened all too many times.
Well, in that major case that only in the last few months that was fortunately decided on behalf of the defendant on appeal, it still cost him a lot of money, a lot of painstaking effort, some time in jail, and it was a terrible tragedy. And even in the end, I understand, at least the last article I saw, there's not going to be much likelihood of him recovering any damages as a result of his situation. I think one of the judges just told him that he was lucky to have his freedom, and that's unfortunate because it was not his fault at all.
Yeah, and why anybody should have to deal with the justice system based on luck, I have a real problem with that.
I agree.
That should never be the case. The justice system is supposed to be fair and balanced. I mean, that's the scales of justice. When the judge has his thumb on the scale, or the system has its thumb on the scale, and through a tremendous weight of evidence, you are able to eke that back to just a hair to your side, and the judge tells you that you're lucky to have your freedom. Yeah, we have a real problem. Yeah. We have a serious problem in a system that we call justice and may or may not be. So the best thing that you can do is to make sure that you don't put yourself in a situation where you have to defend yourself in a place where the scales aren't balanced, and making sure that you don't take possession of your baggage as you go through one of those places is one way that you might be able to keep yourself out of some of that kind of problem.
I want to take just a minute to direct our listeners to an article in the local section of today's Dayton Daily News, where it was titled Shooting Ends Confrontation. And I only bring this up because I know there's going to be emotional response on both sides of the fence. In this particular case, I'm going to summarize quickly the facts. An individual armed himself after his 23-year-old daughter came home and made allegations that another individual raped her overnight. He then, unfortunately, and the facts are as they are described here, decided to take justice into his own hands, and he went over to the alleged rapist's residence and attempted to break into that individual's home. And during the course of that confrontation, the individual inside the house ended up shooting and killing the girl's father. Terrible tragedy. And the only point I want to make, because all the facts aren't known, but I bring it up because I had a little bit of insight from some of the people involved in the investigation of this case, because somebody called me about maybe it being related to some of the things we talk about in our classes. The biggest thing I want to mention here is that we cannot, under any circumstances, take justice into our own hands. The use of a firearm to either threaten or to somehow persuade an individual to see things your way is not going to get things done. The proper response would have been for the father and the daughter to notify the authorities, and for the authorities to conduct their investigation, go conduct an interview of the individual, interrogate him, arrest him based on probable cause, and then let the justice system take its course. In my opinion, this gentleman is unnecessarily dead as a result of taking justice into his own hands, and it's unfortunate. But from the surface, it looks like the actual shooting, absent any other mitigating circumstances, was actually justified. But we're going to go ahead and go to a break. And we come back, we'll maybe have some callers on the line. Call us at 457-1290 if you're interested in getting on the air, and we'll be sure to get you up. You're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Rachel Parsons, spokesperson for the National Rifle Association, and you're on Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro. Welcome back to the show. There's a couple of things I want to talk about real quickly, just to give you a heads up on things before we go back out to the phones. And the first is that on restaurant carry and car carry, that bill... There's two bills. Those of you who've been following the show and following this issue are aware of this. There were two bills, one passed in the House, one passed in the Senate. This week, the House is scheduled, in the House committee is scheduled to take up the restaurant carry and car carry bill from the Senate, the Senate Bill 17, and then they get a vote in the committee, and then that would be part of the process to getting it out on the floor for a vote. So when that would happen, then that bill would be then passed in, assuming there's no changes, would be passed in both chambers and would go on to the governor for signature. So that could happen fairly soon. The other bill is HB 54, which is the Restoration of Rights Bill, and that is scheduled for a possible vote in the Senate committee. So this week, both of those are scheduled for Tuesday this week. This week, I recommend, if you haven't been contacting your state representative and state senator, give them a call. Let them know you support these bills and that you would like them to get this through the Senate and House committees that you would like their vote in favor of passing these bills on to the governor for signature, and that that you know you appreciate their support if they have been supporting it. And I think you should know what that what their position is on these things. Hopefully you've contacted them already, and they will recognize your name when you send in them a note one way or the other. Or if they don't agree with us and they have not supported these bills, encourage them to look again at the details, at the facts, and try to find a way for them to support these bills. Let's go out to the phones and talk to Howard in Camden, who has a comment about firearms on airplanes. Howard, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon, and I want you to know that the information you've given on airline travel with a firearm has been very helpful and very interesting.
Well, thank
you.
But
it brings up the question of ammunition.
Okay.
Does it have to be factory, or are reloads okay? Are there quantity restrictions? How does it have to be packaged?
Okay, let me cover that, because that's a pretty good good adjunct to the what we've already talked about. There's no restriction on the ammunition in terms of whether it's reloaded or whether it's manufactured. For personal carry, I strongly recommend buying manufactured ammunition and not loading your own for that, for a lot of reasons that I don't really have time to go into right now. But there's no restriction on that in the in transport. You do need to either have it in a box, a strong box that's not going to be deformed or fall apart in transport. You can also have it in magazines or clips, as long as they are contained in something that will keep them from leaving in any way. So in other words, if you have a magazine and you have a case for the magazine that covers the end of the magazine and will keep the ammunition from coming out of it if the baggage handlers, you know, toss it, or if it falls off the conveyor or something like that. So that needs to be done. Some of the airlines have specific restrictions on quantity, and you need to read their instructions as well. I don't believe the TSA has any requirement, but there are many in the airline for the various airlines. So typically 11 pounds is kind of a number that goes by. Frankly, if you have guns and ammunition in the same case and you have as much as 11 pounds of ammo, you're going to be hard-pressed to get it in under the 50-pound limit for the bag anyway. So sometimes it's better, if you're going to need that much ammo, to either have it ordered and drop-shipped to the location where you're going, or just take a smaller amount and buy it on your there. Is that kind of answer the question for you?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much. That's very helpful.
Thanks very much for a call on the show. Let's talk to Lambert and Ansonia. Welcome to the show. Lambert, Hello. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi. What's your question real quick?
The question is, I've got a tow truck. I've got a towing business, and I want to know, I know I got to get a concealed and carry permit to carry the firearm. Am I allowed carrying it in my rollback?
Yes, you are. You need to carry it in accordance with the ways that you can carry a loaded firearm, and we'll go over those at another time. We've gone over them before, but there's no restriction on carrying a firearm in a motor vehicle that's a commercial vehicle. Jeff?
I want to take this opportunity to wish my wife a happy 50th birthday and welcome my family to traveling for out of town to have safe travels in town. I want to thank our listeners for listening to Shooting From the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 News Talk Radio, WHIO.